G'day, welcome back to episode 102 of the Sports Medicine Project. I'm your co-host Blake with my co-host Kelly Cortic. Hope you're all doing incredibly well. Hope you're enjoying Monday morning. Monday morning, you always come in, you've had a good weekend, ready for the week. If you haven't had a really long weekend, hopefully you got all your notes and letters done, and hopefully you're starting Monday morning ready to rock and roll with
and
nothing
fresh.
In the inbox
fresh. No letters to write, nothing.
Yeah.
That would be good. That would be a good start to the week, I reckon.
What do you use to keep track of your letters and notes and things to do? Because when you work in musculoskeletal care, typically you have a lot of follow-up. We work with lots of other people and there's lots of letters to do. There's reports for third parties. There's NDIS. There's voice notes. There's letters to do to other practitioners, whether it be physios or chiros.
We use Google Keep. And
Google Keep? I haven't used that one.
Which is quite good. So you can just create little lists and things and you can have it connected with different people. So I've got a letters list that I've got connected with our receptionist, Beck. And so each time we get a patient that is suitable for writing a letter or has been referred from a doctor or has even just included their GP on their intake form, she'll add their name to the list. And then if I feel as though I need to write a progress report to someone, then I'll just add that to that same list. So I just have this list that's Kelly letters that I just make my way through.
Go through. That's a great idea. I mean, that skill is something that when I very first started practicing in my very first clinic, we just didn't really have any good systems in place. And I didn't really have much help with these follow-ups and reminders. And now where I work, you know, I work with lots of other people. So it's really important to have those things in check. So what I find is in the consult, and I'm trying to do this more and more in the consult, if I'm said to someone, yep, I'm going to give you a call after we get this MRI, or I'm going to do this letter to this person, I'm trying to put it in my Asana, and we use Asana. I'm trying to put it in there in real time so I don't forget it, because if you're back to back and you have five patients, sometimes you forget what you said to the person at 9 o'clock compared to 1:30.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you do it in real time? If you say, if you've got a letter to do, or you know you've got to do something, or you're going to send someone some footwear or potentially some exercises or something, or an email about something, do you put that in the list straight away?
Yeah, I mean, I might try and even just do the whole thing in the consult, because I think a lot of the time, sometimes doing that doesn't take as long as you think. So sometimes I try to just dedicate a minute in the consult with the patient to just send that off. Like, for example, sometimes when a patient comes in and they're like, oh, I just need a letter so that my teacher knows that I can't play sport, I'll do that in the consult just to try and
make it a little bit quicker. But they wouldn't come in just for that, would they?
No, not just for that.
That'd be an easy one.
Yeah, at the back end of the consult, if they're like, oh, by the way, can I just have this? Because we've got templates, so it's pretty easy for those ones anyways. Like, it doesn't take that long to fill in.
Mm.
Anyways, we've got a new segment that we wanted to test out this week and hopefully moving forwards, because I think it's quite fun. It's going to be our weekly recap of just little clinical pearls or interesting cases or things that we learned from Monday to Friday. This week, however, there was no clinical pearl on Monday because it was a long weekend, so we didn't work. So we're going to start from Tuesday.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it a clinical pearl. It's purely just something that happened to us.
It might be.
Yeah, it could be a clinical pearl, but not always. It's something happened.
Did you listen to what I said?
You say clinical pearl or case study.
Yeah, or something that we found interesting or...
Okay, yeah. I'll take that. My apologies.
I think you don't listen to me sometimes.
No, I listen to you so much and I love to listen to you. That's my one of
my
favourite things.
You were just on your phone. You weren't listening to anything
I was recording what you were saying so I could listen to it later. I love hearing your voice.
What's your clinical... what thing happened then on Tuesday?
Before we get to that, I just want to give some credit. So we both listen to the Inside Running podcast. I really love that podcast. And they run through their weekly recap and they just talk about their paces and sessions. And it's interesting because it generates conversation, but they're talking about the nuts and bolts of what they're doing, which is running. And I've thought about it for a while. We've tried this now and then. How could we do that in a clinical setting without saying point and direct, this is the exact person that I saw and this is what we did? So we're trying to think some interesting things that we think are going to help people and definitely made us think, and just some clinical scenarios that happen all the time and how we addressed it and then what the follow-up's going to be a little bit later.
Yeah, definitely inspired by the Inside Running podcast for this segment. One thing just to note as well is that we are often changing a few little elements to these clinical discussions. So we are de-identifying the patient by changing their jobs or changing their hobbies or changing their gender or their age, things like that that aren't as clinically relevant in the particular discussion. We are keeping the outcome measures the same. We're keeping the loading patterns and the injury much the same. And we are always asking for consent as well. So just wanted to make that really clear to anyone that is listening, because it can often be a little bit of a tricky space when we are going into depth around certain patient characteristics.
So let's get started. Now, Tuesday, I had an interesting case, and I've seen this person for coming up to 12 months now, unilateral insertional Achilles. So they're a third party case, but for the first 12 months of their condition starting, they saw another practitioner who did some passive therapies, no rule loading and really some stretching and dry needling, and didn't get much improvement at all. A little bit of symptom relief, but no improvement at all. Originally saw me, I think about 10 months ago, and we just started some really basic insertional Achilles loading. Now this person works in a school, and they do lots of high loading activities followed by lots of rest. So they're going, say, throughout the first part of the day, they won't do much at all. Then they might jump in for 50 minutes and play soccer or football with the kids at the school. So over the period of the 10 months, initially we did some shockwave and heel lifts and some high pitch footwear, which worked incredibly well. We started on some really basic endurance and heavy loading. He's got a 25 kilo dumbbell at home. So we did some, dropping below neutral calf raises, some isometric holds, and things were really working well. And then in the last probably 3 or 4 months, we've started to add in some higher level plyos. But what keeps happening is we don't have the tolerance at the moment to be able to do the fast plyometric loading. We keep getting sore or it flares up, and we've built up to about 100 loading cycles. So we can hop and jump and it feel okay. But if we do too much, it flares up for a couple of days. And what keeps happening is it's going really well for a period of time, and then we're at work and we'll jump in and play a sport or we'll do something where the load far exceeds the capacity. It flares up the next day, it's sore for a couple of days, we can't do the rehab, and it kind of spirals down for a week or two. So we take 3 steps forward and a couple of steps back. And the challenging part is trying to help them understand that it's not so much that we're doing the wrong thing, like the loading and the plyometric stuff can make it sore, but we keep flaring it up by doing too much. Because originally we can, for the first time, 10 to 20 minutes, it feels okay, and then it seems to just exceed what it can handle and it gets sore. So have you had this happen before? And I'll talk about how we discussed it. When somebody's able to do a particular movement, which they need to be able to do, but they keep doing too much of it, which then brings them backwards, and you need to help them understand that it's not so much it's the wrong movement, and it's not actually going backwards that much. We're just doing too much of it, and we need to work up slower.
Mm. I think there's a few things within that, and I had a really good discussion with one of my colleagues about flare-ups the other day. I think for a start, it is worthwhile remembering that, yes, rehab's important, but also their life is important. So you need to also factor in some of those life loads into the dose that you're prescribing with rehab. Mm. And so maybe the rehab dose needs to be a little bit less, because they do need to be able to factor in how much load their tendon is getting with life, I think. Sometimes when it's really persistent with those flare-ups, it's worthwhile almost just sitting down and writing down on a piece of paper or up on the whiteboard, like Monday to Sunday, a.m., p.m., like literally writing exactly what they might be doing, so that it's really clear, because sometimes it gives them that visual understanding of the overall load and where they might be doing a little bit too much.
Mm.
Did you have something to say?
Yeah, I probably should have been a bit clearer. So what is happening is it's purely the school is the only load that flares it up, but we have the option not to participate in the sport. So this person is, say, going really well, and then on a Tuesday they're playing, I jumped in and played touch for 50 minutes, or I just jumped in because I was short and we played basketball for an hour, and then it really pulled up sore the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the option not to do that. And they're able to tolerate. So sometimes they might jump in and do 10 to 20 minutes and it's actually okay, but it's just this exceeding the capacity. So it's moving in the right direction, but it really is making it take a lot longer. And the downside is they kind of know that, but we need to help the understanding a little bit more.
I think, though, if that's what they want to do, then that's useful rehab as well. So maybe it would be worthwhile keeping that in there rather than if it feels like you're still having the same conversation, then make the conversation different and make it about something else that can be taken away.
What if they can't just do 20 minutes?
Not necessarily that, but maybe the timing of the rehab exercises. So if they know that school sport's going to be on a Wednesday and a Friday, then rehab can only be on, you know, a Sunday and a Tuesday or something like that.
What if they teach sport every day? Monday to Friday is the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just that knowing of when to stop, because it warms up and it feels good, and then we just go too far. And it's not that it's going backwards in any sense, it's just it's making it take a lot longer because we need to have a couple of days.
But maybe they're okay with that as well. So that's the other thing. So it's hard for us, I suppose, but if they're okay with the fact of knowing that it might be sore after they've done a bit too much, then that's okay too.
The other barrier is it's third party and things end in a certain date. So we're trying to utilize as much as we can closer to that date.
If something is going to be long and persistent, though, I mean, are you expecting that it's going to be completely resolved by that point anyway?
No, but a good goal of ours was to try and get to being able to participate, which sometimes we can, but it's just not as much as we'd like, to be able to get to a full, you know, I can play soccer for 50 minutes and pull up a bit stiff, which we completely, we're well on the same page of, like, having discomfort is normal, but being able to put to then do things the next day and subsequent days after, not really sore. But I thought that was interesting. So one of the things that I did do, and I've done this a couple of times, is drawing a circle up on the whiteboard and saying that currently is our tissue capacity, then drawing a circle around that and saying that's the kind of the load that we're doing. So this buffer zone is how much we're kind of exceeding what we can handle. So what we need to do is keep the outer circle in the inner circle, and over time the inner circle will grow. Now we're also going to be doing a couple of courses of shockwave. So we're going to do 4 weeks of shockwave, which is pretty clear it works, you know, pretty well for insertional Achilles. The research would suggest that as well, in combination with other things, but it's going to give me the chance to then see them more frequently. One of the reflections I had is potentially for myself is I maybe should have seen them closer together, because then I could have reiterated that information rather than say a couple of months apart, because we were going really well. So we did space it out a bit further.
Yeah.
How was your Tuesday?
Yeah, I learned something. Did you know you can repair the ACL? So not do a reconstruction, but if you catch it within, say, like a 2 week window, you can actually, and it's ruptured in the right place, they can actually just repair it rather than having to generate a graft. I didn't know that either.
That's cool.
We don't see it much, and I think the reason that, well, I've actually never seen it.
Yeah.
I think the reason for that is that often it doesn't get it's really hard to get into see an ortho in that 2 week period. And particularly because often after an ACL rupture, it's quite swollen, takes time to obviously get into the GP, get the scan, then get an appointment with the specialist, so they've kind of lost that opportunity. But it sounds like it's quite good. I haven't read anything into it. This is just from an orthopedic specialist that I was talking to on Tuesday, saying that is a possibility to do that, and I wonder why it hasn't been done more. So it's something that I endeavor to look into a little bit further, but keen to hear if anyone has seen it and what their experiences are with it.
Yeah, I wonder if that's, you said it's a more unique scenario, like there has to be these, is it like this criteria?
Yeah, so that I think it has to be, or it's more preferable if it's been ruptured closer towards the femoral condyle and it has to be within like a roughly 2 week period for it to be effective. But apparently rehab can be a little bit more accelerated, and patients report it to have like a bit of a better outcome, in that often they have more of a sense of like it's their knee and it doesn't feel like this weird thing, because it's not this foreign graft that they've had to generate from a different area.
Yeah, it's quite really interesting.
But yeah, I need to read into it more. So this is purely just off what a specialist has said. But yeah, I'm keen to hear if anyone's experienced that and what the result's been.
Yeah, Tuesday, good. Wednesday, an interesting scenario. And we're going to use just... I was thinking of if you would just said John Doe and Jane Doe, because that way you can just say John and Jane for every single case.
Yeah, we can do that.
So if we call, say, John, or just call them or John or Jane. So John, I saw as a an initial consultation. Really common in a podiatry practice to see plantar heel pain, and even more common for a like a compressive plantar heel pain. So really irritable at the medial tubercle, pretty focally, sore to walk on the heel. And this person had heel pain for a really long time, but as well, in combination with that, had persistent back and neck pain and knee pain. So in the initial, and this was a third party as well, in the initial consultation, we spent 40 minutes just going through the subjective. So we just spoke about the history with this foot and back and neck, and they'd seen pain specialists, and they're seeing a current exercise physiologist and a physio, and giving the person that amount of time to just tell me everything and tell their story, I thought was just created a lot of rapport. And I felt like we were on the same page with what I was thinking. They'd had a really bad experience with a pair of custom hard orthotics. And I always, I guess, ask people what's been their experience, if they've seen podiatry before. And I find that's a good question. And they mentioned, yeah, I saw someone, had a really hard pair. I put them on for 10 minutes and I just, everything was so sore and so painful. I just couldn't do anything and I just hated them. So already I've got a bit of an idea that, you know, we're not to jump to say, oh, you need to have orthotics or anything like that, but purely just listen to the story. And it was really insightful. You really can learn a lot from someone in their history just by listening. Now, the caveat to that is because it was third party, I did have extra time. So it may be different in the private paying world, but that was just something I think I've gotten a lot better at. I don't think I would ever have spent that much time going through someone's full history and story and them just telling me, because most of the consult, we just spoke about how having a really sore back and a sore neck can make their heel worse and how there's all these triggers. So when we went out into the gym and did our assessment, we did some calf raises. Heel wasn't sore, the back was sore, and there was so much concern around if we do too much, the back was going, it's like, it just goes and I'm in bed, I'm on the floor for a couple of days. So that foot is obviously the presenting complaint, but there is this person attached to it, and it means so much that I understand that.
Is it possible that the heel pain is referred from the back?
No. It was, we could easily reproduce, you know, with more compressive load and that kind of thing.
My favorite thing, similar to what you've just said, is when patients come in and they're like, let me just give you the short story. And I'm like, no, I want the long story. Like, go into as much detail as you like. I'm more than happy to sort of try and absorb anything that you feel like you need to tell me or want to tell me.
Mm.
And they're like, oh, okay. Like, I just love that. I think that's really nice. And I think they really appreciate that as well.
So yeah. Cool. Yeah. You do wonder, like in this case, I would be so interested to know when this person goes and sees the other health professional who they're seeing consistently for some rehab and movement, what they said about our consult. Like, what is the one thing they remember? Do they remember feeling really heard, or do they remember me just saying, this is what we're going to do, or anything like that? Because I didn't overpromise anything, because I think it's going to be a more persistent case. But it was just really interesting. We honestly spent more time talking about the back and the neck and just the body and how we need to be careful. And
just trying to be a physio, aren't you?
I really just want, I guess from my point of view, I really want them to understand that I know that their back and neck is the main complaint for them. And I asked them that point blank. And yes, we're going to work on the heel as best we can and hopefully get some relief and build the capacity of the heel. But I know what's happening with your back. So I'm not going to make you do all these things for your heel, because I know it's going to make your back sore. So that was kind of the goal of that.
Yeah, nice.
How was your Wednesday?
My Wednesday one is just a quick thing that I, like a little question that sprung to mind.
Yeah, you don't have to be quick. Tell me the full story.
About Joe, who, not, what was it?
Jane.
Jane and Joe?
So John. In emergency medicine, apparently they don't know who it is. They call them John Doe.
John.
And then Jane Doe.
Okay, we're talking about John then.
But we're not going to tell you who swapped or swipped.
Swipped?
Yeah.
What does swipped mean?
Just a word I made up.
Oh, nice. So we're talking about John. John has persistent hamstring pain with running, just broad hamstring pain, this ache through both hamstrings. Can't reproduce it with lumbar range of motion. Can reproduce it though with just repeated hamstring curls to fatigue. Like, that's the pain that comes on. It's like, oh, that's what I get.
Yep.
Particularly notices it when they're running up hills or running a little bit quicker. Yeah. They get that type of pain.
More ham load.
Well, that's it. I was like, can this just be diagnostic? Can, if you're loading something to fatigue and it is reproducing their symptoms, the exact symptoms that they feel when they're running.
Is it pain or cramping?
Well, it's like a discomfort that they experience while they're running. Is that diagnostic enough to say, well, if we can reproduce your symptoms by just loading the crap out of your hamstring and that's exactly what you feel while you're running, is that just fatigue that you're starting to experience in a run? If we've cleared lumbar spine, hip, all of that sort of stuff.
I guess so. I mean, what are the bad, nasty things? I mean, as soon as you say, I'm thinking, well, it's obviously exercise-induced.
Yeah.
So I always think anything that's exercise-induced, I just think it in my back of my mind, and this is just working with the sports doctors, something that's compartment syndrome-like or something vascular.
Mm.
But if you can clear those, well, then I guess so. But what would you call that?
I don't know how you would clear that. I don't even know if that exists back then. Well, probably does, but not something that I commonly hear of is like a vascular-related hamstring pain.
Yeah, you say like...
But calf-wise, because you see that often in the calf too, yeah. Like patients that just get that...
Yeah.
Well, even just that feeling of soreness in their calves with running, or they get that ache and same
sometimes
idea.
Sometimes they're even a pronator.
And then
kidding. I'm sorry. People can't see my face.
And then, but then you'd get them doing calf raises to fatigue and they're like, that's the pain that I get.
Mm.
It's like, okay, well then is it related to just calf fatigue? Like, is it not necessarily a diagnosis in that you've got an injury? You're just fatigued because your capacity is quite poor. And then in relation to that, with John, he didn't have great hamstring strength. So I would suggest that based off that, his capacity to tolerate hamstring loading at a high volume wasn't fantastic, so that it clinically would make sense.
Yeah.
And same with the calf ones that you could see.
Yeah, and is it different? Are you applying different loads to test it differently? So if that comes in and you go, are you saying, great, let's run on the treadmill as one, let's do some fast hamstring loading, and let's do some slow and see out of those three what's most fatiguing, or it doesn't really matter, you're still just loading the hamstring?
Yeah, well, I did some hopping and I did some running and I did like Nordics, hamstring curls, hamstring endurance, hip up bridges, like a bunch of different ways to test the hamstring. The one that was most obvious was just like a prone hamstring curl, because that's directly loading the hamstring opposed to the other ones that are potentially recruiting a bit more compound muscle
and
groups.
It is discomfort. It doesn't feel like it's going to cramp, because I've had that plenty of times.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just was wondering, like that's what I ended up diagnosing them as, and I didn't know how clinically accurate or diagnostically accurate that test was, but I guess it would make sense.
I mean, if you look at all our tests, they're pretty poor for diagnostic accuracy. But I mean, if you can be confident, or at least more confident to say, which I think is a good way to come into it, and I'm really happy to be proven wrong on this, or more right, is coming into a scenario of, what are the big red nasty things that I need to exclude? Can I be somewhat confident to exclude them, rule in the things you're going to work with, and then if it's not improving...
And you would expect it to improve as they got stronger with something like that too.
I reckon in those types of cases, you would expect them to improve in like a couple of weeks, just from like not tendon morphology change or muscle change, but purely just that neural... You know when someone starts doing rehab? I had someone a couple of weeks ago who had 9 months of... unilateral insertional Achilles pain. They did 3x30 seconds of an isometric calf hold, 3x8 of a double leg drop off the step, come back in 2 weeks, 20% better. And they hadn't done any rehab before. 20% better. And in my mind, I'm thinking, there is no way on earth your tendon or your muscle or anything has adapted, but you're feeling like walking more. And yeah, just interesting to see, like, it's not all just about the physiology of the muscle and tendon.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
I guess all intertwined.
All right, Thursday.
Yeah, Thursday was an interesting one. And I'm actually going to speak to a couple of specialists about this one, because it did throw me a little bit. So this was a referral from a specialist, and it was a person with lateral ankle pain just inferior to the lateral malleoli, and really uncomfortable and painful when we're starting something quick. So at push off, so someone's like, hey, sprint 20 meters. The first step when they push off, really sore, and then for the rest, it feels okay. So took out subjective, objective, could reproduce a little bit of pain underneath the inferior mount. I was thinking potentially a peroneal tendinopathy, been going on for a really long time. And there's some other systemic things going on as well. But went out into the gym to do our assessment, and basically I just try to rule in or rule out what I think it is. So if I'm thinking as my kind of provisional is the one where you think first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, provisional first, thinking peritoneal tendinopathy. Well, let's do some tendon testing, which is pretty easy to do some fast range of loading. Doing some hopping and jumping, no real discomfort at all. Most of the discomfort is in max plantar flexion. And if we were to change in our foot position, the symptoms would change as well when we're going up through a calf raise. So really slow movement is sore. Like, yeah, I can just feel it. I can just feel it articulating or a clicking or an impingement kind of sensation. Like, okay, that's interesting. It doesn't seem to be the tendon per se and when it's under that tensile load. So we went back into the room and I put some tape because I was like, is it possible when I'm surely can come up with some better words, but is the tendon getting compressed or impinged or sheared or whatever? So I wrapped some tape around just above the malleoli and we went back into the gym. We did some max plantar flexion, no discomfort at all, no pain, or half a point out of 10. So it was really interesting. And then we did some push-offs and some runs and we took away all the discomfort. So I'm thinking, is it, and I've heard of it, I don't like the pathology, but like the snapping peroneals, which you learn about in uni, how the peroneal, the lateral retinaculum breaks and then the peroneal flicks over. And I'm sure an orthopedic foot and ankle surgeon would be able to correct me on this, but I thought what was happening.
Well, that's binge. Called like a peroneal subluxation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, is it rubbing on the bone or whatever? And it made all the clinical sense. Again, doesn't mean that my tests mean that it is, but treating it that way and targeting that way seemed to get the result. So I thought that was really interesting.
I think the main takeaway from that is just try different things. Like which mechanism by that was effective? I would have no idea.
Yeah, me neither, sister.
Placebo, potentially. But it's worth trialing some of those things just to try and find some sort of symptom modifier and give them a little bit more control over their symptoms, particularly if it's been going on for a while. It's like, oh, well, the fact that this is changeable is awesome. So let's just keep doing this. And while we do that, we'll work on improving these other things that we think are relevant. Mm. And eventually we might not need to use the tape so much.
Yeah. Now I know I can see it in your eye. I know you're getting antsy because we're going to the movies and
yeah,
you want to go and see the trailers.
We've got 2 minutes before we need to leave. Yeah.
People listen to this. Kelly loves to watch movie trailers, which basically she likes to pay and watch ads and
no,
ads
it's
between
just
there.
The trailers.
We've got
it's
enough,
the best
enough
part
time.
Of going to the movies.
But anyway, I know you want to talk about this tendon a bit more. So this is the interesting thing. Add another layer
we
of
complexity
onto this.
We might have to pause it and then come back to it after the movie.
They don't get any, there's no pain during the day. So they're able to do everything during the day without any discomfort. So we're going to pop some heel lifts just to change something. We've got some shoes or a little bit. They just seem to have more ground contact. They're a bit wider through the midsole. We're going to try some heel lifts, which felt better. And I actually gave them a roll of tape to keep the tape on. And I'm just giving them some basic tendon glide. So not tendon loading, but can we do some eversion in funny positions? And can we go to that max plantar flex position and then come back a little bit? So just some graded exposure.
Nice. Can we pause and come back after the
movie? Yeah, well, that's it. We've only got... So you said...
One more. Oh, yeah. Wait.
Achilles rupture.
Cool. So on Thursday, I had a really interesting patient who ruptured his Achilles 6 months ago and didn't do anything about it.
Wow.
I know.
Did that not affect them?
Well, it did. They had pain, or quite a fair bit of pain, actually, and it was swollen. They felt like someone had shot them in the back of the calf, but just thought it would get better. And so just waited and kept walking on it, kept stretching, kept doing all these things, and it didn't improve. So went and saw a specialist, and it's now 6 months down the track. I think probably like 50 to 60-year-old man, John, and there's some other sort of comorbidities that might make a surgery less successful. So the specialist is recommended to try physio and rehab and just trying to work on strength first. And if we can get a good outcome, then hopefully we can avoid a surgery. But
did it reattach?
Well, when you do a Thomas test, it's not as strong as when you do a Thomas test on an unaffected.
Not as much
plantar flexion.
Tone?
No. So like, you know, when you do a Thomas test or Thompson's test, sorry.
Thompson, yeah.
Thompson's test. And you get that sort of like responsive plantar flexion in a non-ruptured Achilles.
Yeah.
Whereas his, it's not as strong of a sort of contraction, but it does have some movement. So it's attached itself, and when he does like a seated calf raise, you can feel that the muscle is contracting, his calf muscle is contracting. So it has reattached itself, but it's reattached itself further up, and he's got a lot more dorsiflexion on that side than on his unaffected side.
So it's going to be a real struggle adding in like pliers and stuff like that.
Oh, he's not going to be doing pliers. He weighs about, his weight is at about 150 kilos. So he's not super keen to get back to
any kind of
plyometric stuff. Just wants to be active enough to be able to play with grandkids, that sort of thing. But yeah, really interesting. Keen to see how it goes. Super lovely man. And he's really motivated to get better, so I look forward to seeing this and share that journey with him.
So Friday, an interesting injection response. So we as podiatrists can legally, if we do a course and we show that we can give corticosteroid injections, and you can do a further endorsement of scheduled medicines. Now I don't do that, but I typically see patients that have had injections, whether it be from radiologists or sports doctors or specialists have sent them off. And I think starting off in my career, I was almost anti-corticosteroid injection. And I don't know why, if it's at the university level, I was just told that it doesn't do anything. Or if you have it, your risk of rupture dramatically increases. Like if somebody is going to, they've failed all the conservative therapy, maybe injection, but they probably should just have surgery. Like, don't even bother trying an injection. And I don't know where that idea came from, because I see lots of people that have great responses to injections, and people that don't have a response, they aren't unhappy with it. They say that, yeah, we tried it and it didn't really work. Sometimes. Or it did nothing. Or, yeah, all right, I got a bit of relief for a month. But it does offer some diagnostic evidence as well. If someone has an injection, or even a local you can have as a diagnostic, and yeah, it took all my discomfort away, have it into the hip or into the midfoot. And it's like, yeah, I had complete relief for a couple of days. You know, we can give you an idea of where it was, or I guess where the nociceptive drive is coming from. But for practitioners listening, I know that people will ask around injections, like, should I have a cortisone injection? And I get the same question all the time of like, should I have surgery? And I have a bit of a spiel of, you know, that's not for me to make that decision. That's for you and the specialist to discuss. They're the expert in that area, and it's up to them to make the decision. And you guys come together to make that decision. And yeah, I try to stay away from that, because there's just so many problems with telling people they shouldn't have surgery if they're about to go and see an orthopedic specialist or anything like that. But yeah, I thought that was just interesting. People can have a good response, and we don't need to say that don't ever have one or kind of scare people into having them. It's the discussion with the other practitioner that's going to be referring.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
This week's episode is with Dr. Christian Barton, who is a physiotherapist down in the cold and miserable, horrible, way worse than Newcastle, Melbourne. No, Melbourne's not too bad. But Christian, many of you will be well aware of his research. He has been pretty well known in the running injury space and patellofemoral and osteoarthritis and health advocacy space. He's published a lot of research, and he works in private practice as well as teaching and doing research. The guy's been busy.
I think it's so great to have that combination of clinical and research knowledge. I think it's very applicable, and I think there's benefit to working in both spaces for both avenues. So yeah, it was really great to talk to him about all of those topics.
Yeah, he's been involved in so much and continues to be involved. So some of the topics that we touched on, of course, running injury, risk factors, patellofemoral pain, clinical management of patellofemoral pain, clinical gait retraining and framework to think about it, how to do it in real time, what happens when you do it, the education and advice that we give, as well as cues. And we just talked really quite a lot about running and knee pain and foot and ankle pain. It was great.
It was good. Christian's course was one of the first courses that I did when I graduated on running injuries and running gaitry training, and it was so great. Like, it was, I still think about a lot of the things that I learned. So highly recommend that course. I do think they pop up somewhat frequently through the APA, so you can check that one out. And yeah, it's covers a lot of different injuries and allows us to build a really strong framework for our running assessment. So if you do need brushing up on that, then I would recommend you check that out.
Yeah, and that'll be down in the show notes. So enjoy this episode with Dr. Christian Barton. The moment, whereabouts are you down in Melbourne? Because your clinic moved, didn't you? We, Kelly and I, both come down and did Rich Willey's course the end of last year. Are you guys still in that?
That was like 12 months ago now.
Was it? Yeah.
It was 12 months ago. So we, in January of last year, we moved from Hawthorne to Richmond. So we were in Hawthorne for about 11 years and just trying to find a bigger and better space to optimize the services that we provide clinically. And we tried to stay within a 1 or 2 kilometer radius, but we're having difficulty finding a venue. And we found this place on Bridge Road, which is a really nice location by the river and really good access to bike and running paths and things, and but also good parking, which is unusual in Richmond. So it's easy for people to get to. And just we had an open plan space. We had to do a little bit of demolition work, but we had an open plan space to build the clinic that we've always kind of wanted.
Yeah.
And what's your split at the moment, Christian? Like, how much are you doing clinically versus research and teaching and other things that you're involved in? Because you wear many hats, and I always find it really interesting to hear about, like, how do you balance that with your, like, life and family and everything like that as well? It must be challenging.
Yeah, so I've got 2 days of clinical work that I do. So they're usually pretty big days. So I probably do 15 or 16 hours of clinic work a week. And I see a mixture of patients that are from really elite athletes through to very sedentary people, mostly lower limb. A lot of them are knee related and tendinopathy related. And I also see, I have a specialist interest in running. So probably half the patient population I see are runners or wanting to get back to running or do running-based sports. And then 3 days a week, or yeah, 3 days a week-ish, I'm at La Trobe University, and I have a role there in as teaching and research. So I do a little bit of teaching, which is mostly around coordinating and curriculum development for the postgrad MUSC and sports masters programs at the moment. Occasionally do some undergrad teaching into some exercise focused subjects, and then the rest of my time is in research. And I have a big team, or multiple big teams of researchers I work with, in projects from end stage knee OA, trying to avoid joint replacement surgery, through to running populations with post-traumatic knee injuries, to clinical trials with ACL populations. And I support some other research groups doing oncology rehab, low back pain, heel pain, with a sort of area of research that I've become more specialized in, which is called implementation science. So basically, it's just a fancy way of saying trying to understand why what we know should help people doesn't actually get applied in the real world, and then trying to develop solutions to actually achieve that and actually change what clinicians do. And then outside of that, I've got, yeah, 3 young kids who keep me busy running around them. We juggle childcare with my wife, and so we manage to keep them out of childcare, and so lots of school pickups and drop-offs, and they're really active and enjoy their running. So they're 4, 6, and 8, and they can all comfortably do parkrun and have some times would beat most of the grown-ups chatting on here. So their times range between 22 and a half minutes for the 8-year-old to 28 minutes 10 for the 4-year-old. Yeah.
That's but sweet. You're running along with them. What do you do, pacing, or you left in the dust?
I'm not left in the dust yet, but I think my 8-year-old, if I went back maybe 3 years ago, I think he would have beaten the 37-year-old Christian, but the 40-year-old Christian's gotten faster. So I've still got him, but by less than 2 minutes at the moment over 5Ks. So I think I'll be in trouble. But most of the time I just run with them and just take in turns of pacing them, and they can run park runs themselves these days without getting lost. So they'll sometimes just run off by themselves, and as long as we've got some visibility of them, they're okay.
Yeah, you'd just be out the back late at night doing some pogos, trying to increase that Achilles stiffness to make it get a bit quicker and a bit economical.
Yeah, no, I've probably just embraced doing some speed work in the last couple of years and actually getting to the track, which I just used to go for a run to clear my mind. And now I'm, yeah, getting back and actually trying to play footy again has made a difference too, because that's obviously a lot more sprint activities.
Yeah. So with your career and where you are now, like you're involved in so much and so many different, I guess, avenues of research and clinical practice and all these different conditions, although they're very connected. What's been kind of your origin story? Like, how did you get to the point of now doing a mix of private practice and research, which seems like one of the best combinations you can have? Because, you know, we talk to academics who are purely doing academia and the clinicians, and it does seem to be a little bit of a divide. The people we've found have the most nuance and understanding of the people that are doing a combination of both. Was that always something that you wanted to do, or did you think with yourself, that's probably the best way I'm going to be able to implement and get the outcomes for my patients and also move the profession and these understanding and concepts forward?
Yeah, I think probably, I guess the mixture of both started probably as a student and doing my undergrad, and I had the opportunity to honours. I was actually the only one in my year level in Albury where I went to uni at CSU who put their hand up to do it. And I was really interested in just learning more about research and understanding whether that was something I might want to do. And then when I graduated, I worked for a year and a bit full time, just clinically, honing skills. And then I just had the itch to go back and do research for probably what you'd mentioned is just feeling like doing research, I could probably become a better clinician. And I think being a clinician makes you better at research as well. So I got talked into doing a PhD pretty quickly in my career. I was told, look, you haven't got any family or any kids yet, so now's the perfect time to do it. So I started it quite young. I was only 22, 23 when I started. And I continued to work clinically through that and spent a few years doing the PhD. And most of my research initially was more biomechanics and looking at foot orthoses and patellofemoral pain. I've always been fascinated with biomechanics and I still am. And I love 3D motion analysis and kinematic measurement and trying to understand how we can tailor treatments based on some of that information. Over my journey, I've learned it's probably oversold as to what we can actually achieve with biomechanical assessment and thinking through how we design interventions. And I sort of made this transition when I was in London to start to do some qualitative research when I got thrown some projects to do interviews with clinicians about how they practice. I'd never done any interview studies before, and I just got handballed a project that needed to get finished. And that sort of, I guess, lit a fuse to start to think more about the knowledge translation aspect and the fact that we don't really translate information into clinic. And so slowly over time, I started to do more and more of that type of research, but still having students and things working with different biomechanical studies. So now my research spans all spectrums from biomechanics and very much physics and I guess mathematical modeling. I don't do any of that, but I just enjoy looking at it with what students and others do that I work with, all the way through to behavior change research with clinicians, patients. And probably the challenging part is trying to change policy and funding for different services, which is where I have a lot of fun trying to understand the barriers and see if we can develop solutions for that.
There's so many layers to research that complicate things, I suppose, in terms of, you know, having that initial research question and trying to make it very clinically relevant, but then trying to, yeah, battle through a lot of those other things that a lot of clinicians probably don't really understand what they are and how that complicates things.
Yeah, and I think we're going to talk about gait retraining and running analysis in a little bit, but that's a really good example where you've got research paradigms and research projects that are really easy to do from a control research perspective. So I'll give you an example of you might look at measuring step rate and implementing a gait retraining strategy to change step rate. It's very measurable, it's very easy to change, so therefore it's very easy to research. But then if we actually look at what gait retraining can be and you start to look at all the nuances of what you can try in clinical practice, that's much harder for us to kind of define and research and set up a really clean research question. So those projects still interest me, but the really interesting ones is the messy real world stuff of when we get clinicians to implement things. And instead of telling them every little detail they need to do, we actually let them use a framework and go and do something, and then we actually explore what they actually did, and what might be the drivers of why they got good outcomes or not. And that's, I think that's more fun.
What do you think are some of the contextual things that happens in the clinic when we're looking at, I guess, two models, one the biomechanical and the other of, you know, treating the person through the biopsychosocial lens? What contextual things help people improve when we do all this gait retraining and biomechanical data? Like, you see a lot of the research where you change something and usually someone has less pain or they feel better. And, you know, the question is, could you just change anything rather than going purely down the very biomechanical lens and people seem to improve? Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just moving tissues around or it's contextual effects of patient practitioner?
Yeah, I ponder this all the time. So I think if we stay on the gait retraining theme, we might change someone's running mechanics and their knee feels better when they run. The mechanism for that could be very much in the biomechanical paradigm, in that we've maybe reduced how much peak knee flexion they get and therefore there's less stress on the patellofemoral joint. That's certainly the way I clinically reason when I'm thinking about doing it. Or we might get less dorsiflexion for someone who's got Achilles tendinopathy at mid-stance. So that would be biomechanically something we consider as possibly therapeutic. But is it that leads them to have a better outcome? Is it time we never have the opportunity to have a control group when we've got the N of one in front of us? So were they going to just get better anyway? We're never really going to know that. Is it the fact that I'm sitting there telling them, explaining their video of what's going on and what might be linking to their pain, and then I'm giving them a solution that they can achieve, so they've got the self-efficacy to achieve it. They achieve that and then therefore they've got more confidence. And I may not have been the key driver of the mechanics and the tissue stress, but it might have been that they've become really sensitized and really fearful of loading, and I've given them confidence that they're now loading better and they're now safe to continue to load. So I don't think you can ever really tease it out all that easily. I often ponder it. I think we've got to get better in our research areas of trying to put these things together and actually assess baseline characteristics of people. So if you're going to do a biomechanical study, great, measure the biomechanics, but let's also measure things like self-efficacy, pain sensitization, other beliefs and things like that. And also, if you think about the biopsychosocial model, well, what about their sleep, their diet, a whole range of other things, and start to have some, I guess, more complex study designs where we can start to look at mediation analysis of things that might change, and that might tell us why they got better or not. To do those types of studies, though, you need really big funding and you need really big numbers of participants to come through and do it. And unfortunately, running-based research doesn't get a lot of funding. Probably easy to do in populations like knee OA, in people who are more sedentary.
Except running's getting pretty popular, so maybe we might see there's a bit more of an incentive.
I think we can change the narrative of funding for running-based research if we can focus it more on participation and the health benefits of that. Because I think if you think about the public health message and concept, and this is what I always start my running course with, is we look at the start and we go, okay, what are the risks and benefits of running? And the benefits are so big. Regular, moderate to vigorous physical activity, if you can be participating in that, which running's a really easy option for many people and an enjoyable option, there's at least 35 different chronic diseases you're going to prevent. So if a sore knee is stopping someone being able to participate in those running activities, or the advice they've been given by the surgeon never to run again because they've got some knee osteoarthritis, if we can intervene with that population, get them running again and have some physical activity and general health outcomes, that might be something that's a little more fundable. So I think we've got to think carefully about the narrative when we're pitching grants and things.
How do you think we have evidence that we can use running to, say, prevent these chronic diseases, but we don't have research to say that, say strength training can prevent running-related injuries? Is it because of the level of funding that needs to go into these chronic diseases because of the level of the burden that it places, or is it just because there's so many factors that can be influencing an injury opposed, well, I mean, I guess that would be the same in a chronic disease. Like, what do you think the big difference is there?
Yeah, so I guess you sort of got to join a dot to say that helping someone run again is going to mean that they are more physically active than they would have been if they didn't run. And then therefore that's going to prevent the chronic disease. Whereas if we can do exercise, any form of exercise, doesn't have to be running, we know that prevents a chronic disease. So if you're going to look at an intervention then to get someone to run again, alternatively, if you want to play devil's advocate, why don't we just do a swimming study or a cycling study in that running population and get them to be physically active there? But you guys know that runners being told, actually, running's not the best option for you, we're not going to try and help you get better at running and run again, we want you to go and take up swimming or cycling, that's not all that palatable for people for lots of reasons. Mm. It's not very convenient for them from a form of exercise. They don't get the same mental health benefits from that form of exercise. So, yeah, it's tricky. I don't know if I answered your question, but I hopefully give some idea about the complexity of it.
Mm, for sure, yeah.
And we also, like, on the strength training thing, does strength training help running injuries or prevent them? We don't really know.
That's it. We don't know.
That's our next question that we want to ask you on that topic, because that's the one that we talk about a lot, because we love resistance training. It's good for bones. It's good for tendons. It seems to have all these benefits of all these other things, like your systemic health, mental health, blood markers, everything. But when we look at the studies, which aren't, again, they're not the greatest because they're shorter and they're not adequately powered, but it doesn't consistently show to reduce the risk of running injuries. Do you have any idea as to why that is? And do you still give the recommendation that runners should be strength training, even if they don't have an injury or haven't had an injury? And what does the research need to look like for us to get a win on the board and say that it helps?
Sure. So there's probably two populations here, isn't there? There's the uninjured population and then there's the injured population. Does the uninjured population need to do strength training? I think it's advisable, not to necessarily help their running. I don't think we have any clear evidence of that. I'm unsure as to whether it would prevent injuries. We just don't simply have good programs to test. So James Alexander and I have had many conversations about this. So he's a master's student who's just finished, who published a really great systematic review in BJSM, and it was looking at prevention of knee-related running injuries. And we didn't find any evidence that it can prevent it. But the problem was, all of the studies, they're like 3 to 8 week intervention periods, maybe 12. The dosage of exercise is not intensity enough, not progressive enough that would actually induce any strength training changes. So what we're looking at really is just a low level resistance training program and seeing if that can prevent injuries. And the answer to that is probably not. So we don't have the research to do that. We do have the research that if a runner wants to run faster and they do strength training, that will help them run faster. So as a way of mitigating injury risk, I'm pretty positive on the fact that probably doing some strength training instead of going nuts and trying to do crazy amounts of running is probably a better option and a safer option. A study to test that would be nice, but it makes logical sense to me. If the runner doesn't want to run faster, should they still do strength training if they're injured? I'd say yes. And the primary reason is all the other health benefits, which you mentioned, and notably things like bone density. So the osteogenic effects of running for a runner is pretty low, but if you can do some more strength training and higher intensity loads through your bones, you're going to get better bone density. There's also other benefits to it as well. So that's the non-injured population. In the population with an injury, similarly, we just don't have quality studies that have tested a strength training program in a rehab setting. And I would argue in most conditions, we actually don't know the effects of strength training on many injuries, because most studies only go for maybe 8 weeks, 12 weeks if we're lucky. And we know that a painful population, they're going to have a lot of inhibition to doing loading. So maybe that first 3 or 4 weeks, it's just building some self-efficacy to start loading. They may then start to progress to doing more resistance. In a patellofemoral population, we found a few years ago, we could probably progress them to loads that would resemble a strength stimulus after maybe 3 or 4 weeks was the typical time frame. And we could probably start rate of force development power exercises after about 5 to 8 weeks in our cohort. So that leaves us, if we've got a 12-week study, probably only 6 or 7 weeks of actual resistance training that would resemble a strength stimulus, which we know is not long enough to facilitate any great muscle hypertrophy. And considering most studies go less than that 12 weeks, we just don't have the evidence to test whether strength training is effective for managing injuries either.
Mm. With your runners that you're seeing in the clinic, what are you talking about when you're going through the resistance training in the injured population? What are you going through, I guess, your goals of doing the strength training? Like, I had 2 Achilles tendinopathies today, and both people were incredibly strong. They could calf raise, they could jump, and it would hop. It was this divide of the Achilles tendon was strong and robust and had the capacity. It was just sensitive. So doing strength training, I don't think it wasn't a limit of they were weak. It was some inhibition and it was painful and the load was too much. So what are you saying to people when you're going through this resistance training? Because it's not always just getting a tendon from weak to strong or getting their knee from weak to strong. There's other things happening.
Yeah. So it's probably two parts that if we just stick to the strength components rather than diving into the biopsychosocial part, which is probably more important, but let's stick to the strength part. I guess if locally to the area they're really strong and they're really resilient and you're really confident. So if you use your Achilles example, you've tested soleus, you've done that with some seated heel raise, you're happy with that. You've tested gastroc, you've done some weight bearing heel raise work, and you're happy with their strength there. You've done some plyometric testing and you're happy that they can jump and hop and do counter movement activities with decent power. So you've ticked all those boxes. You've got to really probably then think about the rest of the kinetic chain as well. And so in many of the runners that I see, that is often the case because I'm often the second or third or fourth or sometimes fifth person they've seen. And they've done a really good rehab program with other clinicians. And then we might move more proximally with some of our assessment. Actually, what we discover is their core strength and their hip strength is actually really impaired. So they're really strong distally in this example, but they're really weak proximally. And in those cases, then often a really key missing link in the rehab they've been doing is actually getting them stronger more proximally and then doing some gait retraining to teach them to shift the load. And that can be a really effective strategy clinically. Now, if I was to assess, we'll use the same Achilles example, assess all these other muscle attributes, they're all great. We look at their running mechanics. We're very happy with their running mechanics. There's nothing we think we need to shift or change there. Then the conversation then needs to really focus on the bigger picture of what else is actually going on in that person's life. Because there's always going to be an answer of what's going on. And it's about trying to tease through that. And it might be that they're not sleeping well. They're super stressed with work. They're just not giving themselves that adequate recovery time. They're not eating properly. Maybe there's some medications that they're taking. I had an interesting case this week of someone who had a navicular stress fracture and then going back and looking at their load management, it's like it didn't make sense to me that they should have a navicular stress fracture. They're coming back from some cartilage injuries in their knee and they've been really slow, really progressive, done really good rehab program. And I don't know the evidence for this, so you guys might be able to answer this here, but they've been on the weight loss drug that they use for diabetes. I've got the name of it.
The ozapam? Yeah.
So I'm very curious as to what effect that might have on bone density, but equally, regardless of that, they've lost a ton of weight along the way, so they're probably not fueling their body to actually do bone remodeling, et cetera. So that's probably the key thing for them. So the short answer to it is, I think, from a strength perspective, you need to do a really good screening of the whole kinetic chain. And where there's impairments, you address them. And you don't address isolated impairments, and I'll say this really importantly to everyone listening, by doing functional exercises. So doing squats, deadlifts, et cetera, you're not going to address an isolated impairment. You actually need to do an exercise that targets that individual impairment. Make sure you tick all those boxes. Make sure you improve their running mechanics as best as you can so they're putting less stress through the area that is sensitized. And then from there, it's load management, also the bigger picture, what else is going on in their life.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've got an interesting sort of story about patellofemoral pain. So when I first started uni, it was the very first literature review that I had to do in musculoskeletal physiotherapy number one or whatever that first course was. And they said, okay, off you go, literature review on patellofemoral pain about trying to work out what it is. And I got into this moment where I was like, how can we be studying physio and reading all of these articles and we still don't know what patellofemoral pain is? I mean, I'm learning to be a physiotherapist. There's no way that we can still be so unsure about what is causing this pain. It's so vague and no one really can describe it. And that was the first like glimpse into the questions that we still have around our profession. And now I probably still don't understand exactly what causes patellofemoral pain, but I do feel a lot more confident in how to manage it and how to make sense of it to patients. So I do my best job too. But yeah, that was my first experience with managing or having to, I guess, deal with patellofemoral pain and hear about it. And yeah, I thought that would be quite relevant in this conversation.
we don't know the source of symptoms, but arguably the source of symptoms in many conditions is like that too. It's not just patellofemoral pain. We see that in many other things like knee OA in general, hip OA in general, low back pain. We can have hypotheses about what the structural source or nociception might be, but to really pinpoint, it's pretty rare to be able to do that. for conditions can certainly be done. Something like a stress fracture or a really isolated tendinopathy. But most of the times when you see a tendinopathy, yep, start of a tendinopathy, but there's all this other stuff going on alongside it. And so I think the best way to approach that with the patient in front of you is just be honest and go, look, there could be this, this, and this going on. It's not exactly clear, but my hypothesis is probably this. Regardless of which one of these things it is, these are the solutions that we're going to implement for you. And if you do implement these solutions, there's a very good chance you're going to get better. And I think that's the way to approach it rather than trying to be 100% confident in diagnosis. I often say to people, if someone tells you, I know exactly why you've got pain, then you probably need to get out of there. Go somewhere else.
I agree.
Yeah.
What biomechanical data do we have that shows the biggest reductions in loads on the knee? So as an example of patellofemoral pain.
Yeah, so from a research perspective, if you want to look at knee joint loads and what gait retraining strategies are out there, the most effective way to reduce load on the knee would be transition from a rear foot to a non-rear foot strike pattern. So you're depending on which paper you look at and the magnitude of step rate change, strike pattern compared to step rate, I'll come back to it in a second. But depending what sort of study you see, it'd be around 20 to 25% reduction on knee joint loads. The other commonly researched one is step rate, and depending on magnitude of step rate, that will typically sit maybe close to the 15% mark. So that's probably your two main researched options. Clinically, I don't really use strike pattern all that much with patellofemoral population, and the main reason is that I like to think of this framework called RISC. So we wrote an editorial on this a few years ago. So if you can put your interventions into this, it can keep things a bit safer, I think. So R is for reducing overall load. I is for improving capacity. So we do that through grade of exposure. We do that through strength and conditioning. S is for shifting load, which you need to be really cautious of. So when you think about strike pattern, that's a load shift. So you might actually injure another area. And K is keep adapting to the person in front of you. So it depends what their goals are and what they're able to actually achieve. So you need to tailor it to each person. So something like a step rate intervention where you're increasing step rate, you probably going to reduce overall load in most cases because you're going to get them landing closer under their center of mass, which means you've got less braking force. And so you're not just going to reduce load on the knee and the patellofemoral joint, but you probably reduce tissue load overall through the whole lower limb. Whereas if you just change strike pattern, you might just shift some load around. Clinically, I tend to work a lot more with people around pelvic positioning and trunk positioning and hip and knee mechanics in terms of swing phase and trying to change the way someone lands. And I find that's actually a lot more effective and often safer, especially compared to strike pattern, at trying to reduce on load on the patellofemoral joint. And ultimately, it doesn't matter what you do. It does matter what you do. But the goal, regardless of what you're trying to do, is to really try and reduce a bit of loading at impact, but particularly at mid-stance. So what you're trying to do is reduce your peak patellofemoral joint forces, and that's going to happen through reducing peak knee flexion primarily. So rather than focusing on hip adduction, internal rotation, that we often all get obsessed about, actually most of your forces are coming in the sagittal plane. So if you can reduce peak mid-stance knee flexion, then you're probably going to be on a winner in terms of reducing symptoms, at least in the short term. And I think you can achieve that through a lot of proximal cueing and thinking about exercise and approaches more proximally.
What sort of proximal cueing are you referring to around the pelvis with like a running assessment in particular?
So I'm always very interested in someone's sagittal plane pelvic position, particularly at impact, because that's going to dictate a lot of what muscle function you can achieve. So if someone's in a lot of anterior pelvic tilt, it's often a lot harder for them to get engagement of their gluteal muscles and their lower abdominal muscles. So it's going to be harder for them to shift load there away from the knee. The other thing that going into more anterior tilt does, just because of the change in the acetabular position, will actually push you into more hip adduction internal rotation. It will push you into more knee flexion and ankle dorsiflexion through mid-stance if you stay there as well. So if they stay anteriorly tilted through gait. If you go relative terms more posterior tilt, it will reduce all of those things. It'll actually reduce your peak knee flexion through mid-stance. It'll reduce your hip adduction, internal rotation, reduce ankle dorsiflexion if you're treating something distally. The challenge isn't so much that theory around what you're doing, it's how you actually achieve it for the person. And that's where you can't just give them a cue. Like a simple cue would be tuck your bottom under, engage your lower abdominal muscles, or push your hips forward. If you use that cue alone, they might end up leaning backwards or overcorrecting. You need to have a look what are the barriers to achieving that. So it might be hip mobility, it might be strength and muscle power through gluteal muscles, hamstring, lower abdominal muscles. So you need to be doing some assessments of all these things to work out where their barriers might be. And then sometimes, or most times, concurrently implementing some rehab to address some of those barriers so you can actually achieve some of those changes more proximally.
If they have the strength and the mobility, how are you recommending they implement this into their running? Let's just say they're running 5Ks four times a week. Are you asking them to do it for the whole 5 kilometers or try a time period or a distance period and see how it feels?
Depends on the irritability of their running, and going back to the risk analogy, it depends on where they are, right? So if they're about to do an event in 3 or 4 weeks, which is where most people present to us as clinicians, we're probably not going to try too much of it at all. We might give it as an option if it helps their pain in the short term and go, hey, if your knee's getting sore, why don't you try this for a period of your run and just see how you go. If you're trying to make the change sustainably in the future and they're not too irritable, they might continue to run their 5Ks and they just implement it for the whole run initially, and they just have a walking break as needed. It's more a psychological break than anything when you're trying to change mechanics. And then they run again, and they do that for pretty much their whole run. And then over time, you get them to try and think about it less and less. And the whole idea about it is it's really about the whole faded feedback design, which is used in a lot of the gateway training literature. If, however, someone's sort of coming back to running, in some ways they're easier because you can actually do it as part of a return to run program. So, for example, I'll often use just 2-minute blocks of running. So maybe the first few runs they're doing 2 by 2 minutes with a 1-minute walking break. That's very easy to implement it the whole time. And they just go for it. And then they'll go to 3 by 2, 4 by 2, et cetera, and they just implement the whole time. So as they return to run, they also change their mechanics as they're getting back to running as well. But if you actually want to truly change something in the way that someone runs, you can't kind of do it for some of your runs and then not others because you'll just keep slipping back. It's like if you were playing golf, which I'm terrible at, tennis I do a little better at, but you try and change some things with those activities, you can't go back to your old habits and expect it. What you're trying to work on to improve is going to stick, and running is no different. The good thing about running is it's a lot easier to change than your golf swing.
Definitely, I agree with that. Do you use many adjuncts in your clinical practice? And I've followed your work a while, looking at, you know, foot orthoses for patellofemoral pain, looking at that recent. Not too recent, but that review that was in BJSN and include like Maximus and Rocket Sole shoes for knee pain. Like, do you use any adjuncts for knee or foot and ankle or for even hip pain, like foot orthoses or shoes?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on the population that I'm seeing. So if we're talking about patellofemoral pain population, if I start with foot orthoses and footwear, we know foot orthoses can be really effective for that population who are more sedentary. So they've more got walking and standing based activities, and the number needed to treat from the research in the short term is between 2 and 4. So it's a pretty inexpensive adjunct that you can give them. Mm. My whole PhD, I can tell you the one liner that comes from that in one sentence now, and that is, if you can reduce someone's pain in the short term with a simple activity like a squat, then it will help them at the 12-week stage. So you just use that as a clinical test. If it doesn't help them, don't use it. If it does help them, then it might be something they can do.
As in, like, something at foot level, then get them to squat and just see how it feels. Yeah, that's exactly. Pretty simple. Yeah. That's pretty simple to do with this over the counter. And so
there's my 3.5 years of work.
It's all that sentence.
Might have learned a couple of other things, but that's a key takeaway.
Could you like low dye? So for me, who I don't have orthotics in the clinic, could I like low dye tape them to say replicate what an orthotic might do and do that? Yeah. Like, try a squat, and then if that's effective, then refer on to podiatry for orthotics, or would that not be the same?
No, so you can. There's certainly, that's better than not doing anything, right? But it probably doesn't have the same mechanical effect as the orthotic will. So if you low dye, it might not have as much of an effect as the orthotic will. If you do more of an augmented low dye taping technique, or actually come up onto the tibia and on the shin, that actually has a bigger biomechanical effect than orthotic will. So it's not exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So you could easily just put some folded up tissue paper, tissue wrapped in some sports tape, and fashion something, some felt, and play around with that way, or even just use your hand to support the arch while they do the squat. Just play around with something like that. That would be helpful to do. I don't tend to send many patellofemoral pain patients to podiatrists. Sorry to the podiatrists listening out there, but like, usually a prefab is fine and it's really short term. There's a lot of other things to work on. But stay with my podiatrist a second. I send almost everyone that has foot and ankle pain to you guys, because that local level knowledge and orthotic prescription can be hugely valuable for that population. We go back to tarsophemoral pain, staying at the foot level, shoes could absolutely play a role in that population. We don't have research on it, but certainly having in a more sedentary population something with a little bit of a heel lift or something like that where we're maybe compensating for a lack of dorsiflexion, if that's there, that can be useful. If we look at the running population, it really comes down for me about how someone runs as opposed to what's under their foot. And so if someone can achieve some of the gait retraining strategies to reduce their overstride, land with less impact forces, reduce their peak knee flexion at mid-stance in their gumboots, then they can keep wearing their gumboots. That's okay. If they can't, and the shoe's a barrier because it's got a really chunky heel or it's really got a really thick stack height, then I might start to think about more minimalist approaches for them. And I'll trial maybe even some barefoot running just as an assessment and see how much easier we can achieve what we're trying to achieve. And then I get them to go to a good shoe store and get a bit of help with finding some more minimalist shoes. And we'd make a very sensible transition towards that, as in maybe only doing 20% of their running initially in that shoe and making gradual changes, but also working on their gait changes. If we go to other adjuncts moving more locally, I would probably use taping in most of my patellofemoral populations, because I think if you tailor it and you play around with a few different options, so you can think about not just glide of the patellofemoral joint, so medial glide, you can also play around with rotation as well, and you can do some taping techniques to do that. You can do things like offload the fat pad, which is often quite sensitized. In almost all circumstances, I can help someone reduce their pain with some taping. Probably the one group who that doesn't work so well for, or two groups, would be if they've really got some significant PFJOA or if they've got some really significant bone edema as part of their presentation. Because if they've got bone edema, that compression will often make it sorer. But you try it, and if it works, you use it. If it doesn't work, then you've lost 5 minutes of your life. You've lost 5 minutes of the patient's life and a little bit of tape. If it helps, they've now got a really good option they can do that's going to help them on a day-to-day basis over the next few weeks. And the research, there's not a lot out there, but there is one study that looks at using that type of taping approach or actually tailor a little bit to the person in conjunction with exercise compared to exercise alone. And over the space of a couple of months, people get better faster. So there's a little bit of, and that makes logical sense. But is the taping going to get in the way of me educating them and providing exercise? No. So I can think of an example even yesterday in the clinic where at the end of the session, I actually said to this girl, I said, look, I think we can find some taping to help you. But I didn't spend any time on it yesterday because the priority was actually giving them some education and trying to reduce their fear and trying to get them exercising. So, and then if we move to things like soft tissue, that can certainly help in the short term. We don't understand the mechanisms. Does it matter? Probably not, as long as we're not spitting rubbish to them about what might be happening. But we could do some soft tissue work on lateral quadriceps, lateral hamstring, which the theoretical concept is it reduces tension through that area. We might do some work on the anterior hip, which might allow us to get some better gluteal muscle function, which can help us. And again, it's about doing treatment direction tests when you're doing this stuff, right? So similar to the orthotic. So if you spend a couple of minutes doing some manual therapy and it helps their pain and symptoms, teach them how to do something similar themselves at home. If you can't change their pain in a couple of minutes from some manual therapy, you're probably not going to change it after 15 minutes of manual therapy. So just move on and do something else. And that's generally my, I guess, process with it. So I don't spend long on those things. It's really a couple of minutes at a time.
Yeah, that's good. That's good advice. And then when we talk about rehab, a lot of the research compares local muscle strengthening to like proximal muscle strengthening. Is it a sensible approach to just do both? Or do you think that it does need to be specifically tailored? Do you think it does need to be specifically tailored to their deficit?
Yeah, so I'll start with the research and then I'll go to clinic. So the research would tell us that possibly starting proximally instead of starting locally, you probably get better short-term improvements in pain. But if you start locally in the longer term, you're still going to do well. And in reality, you're doing both of them together in the longer term, you get better outcomes. Now, clinically, if we think about why in the short term, proximal versus local might be more beneficial, it's probably because most people presenting are probably overloading that area when they come to us, and us giving them local exercise may actually just be more load in that area. So for me, clinically, it depends how irritable they are at the time. So if I can give them some local exercise to start to address impairments I find with hamstring and with quad, and that's not irritating their symptoms, then I'll do that from day one. And then I would then also be looking for, going back to your tailoring to the person, I'd be looking for what proximal impairments they might have, and that's not just the hip but also lower abdominal muscles, and I'd also screen for distal stuff as well, and you tailor the program based on what you find with your clinical assessment. So if they're super super strong, then I'm not probably going to prioritize exercise in that area to start with. I might then start thinking about, okay, we've done a strength assessment, is it actually rate of force development they're lacking? Is that something we need to start to address? So maybe they've been doing a lot of rehab and building their strength, so heavy, slow resistance type training, but they haven't been taken through the process of restoring rate of force development, and this person's trying to go back and play basketball or run or do certain activities. So starting to have a look at that then as well. Or if they're ticking all those boxes, then you go back to the whole biopsychosocial model and what else is going on in their life? Is it just that they're super fearful and they've got a lot of pain sensitization, and there's other stuff around sleep and diet? And I mean, we're a female, we'd be thinking about menstrual cycle as well and having conversations with that. And that's something that's often not covered by many clinicians, but can be a really important part of the presentation of many musculoskeletal conditions.
Mm. When someone comes in to the clinic, and let's say that the common scenario for myself would be somebody will come in for a running assessment, and there's two different populations. One population that have some form of injury, generally for me being a podiatrist, it's below the knee. I'm not seeing too much hip injuries. And the other population would be asymptomatic. Do you think for the asymptomatic population coming in for a running assessment, there is any indication that we should change something? And we think about their tissues and how they adapt over time. If we're thinking pragmatically, the way that they have been moving has been okay. They haven't had any injury. Their tissues have obviously adapted to that movement pathway. Would you ever change someone's, I guess, technique or the way that they run based off what we understand about the research? And from what I've read, potentially maybe there's some things in hip drop and hip position, but really there's not a lot of clear evidence to say changing this will reduce your injury risk in the future, and it's impossible to study.
Yeah. So I guess the whole premise of medicine is first do no harm, right? So we've got to keep that in the back of our mind. So I would, if someone come in for me specifically for a running assessment and asked, is there anything I should change to reduce my risk of injury? I'd certainly do a video with them and have a look at it. And the only things I'd really look for, and I wouldn't tell them with any confidence it's going to reduce their injury risk, but I'd be looking for a slow step rate or potentially that overstride. So they're just landing further in front. So if they're landing a foot length or more out in front of their body, and they've got a slow step rate, then I might have a conversation with them. Hey, you've probably got some pretty high impact forces going through your system. There are some ways we can reduce it. When we do that, if we try to increase your step rate, it's going to be harder work. You're going to use your hamstrings more, so they're going to get tired and sore. We might play around with your pelvic position, for example, like I was talking about before, and that's going to be a little bit harder work, but they're going to be safe things to do by and large, so we're probably not going to reduce your injury. I'd have a conversation with them and ask some questions about what they've been told reduces injury risk, because that might bring out that, oh, someone's told me I need to change my strike pattern to reduce my injury risk, in which case you can kind of debunk that and have a chat to them. Actually, it'll probably increase your injury risk, so go through that. But by and large, I'd use it as an opportunity to say, look, there might be a couple of things we can tweak from an injury perspective, but we don't have any solid evidence that it is going to help. But the other thing that you need to consider is everything else that might contribute to an injury. So let's have a conversation about the rest of your lifestyle. Let's have a conversation about making sure that you're strong. And I'll do some screening around resistance training. We mentioned that strength training, there's no evidence to suggest that it prevents injury. But if I find an area that's really impaired, it might be hamstring muscle strength and power, then I'd probably suggest to them that they do some resistance training to address that. And I also frame that conversation around performance as well. So the whole point of trying to maybe reduce overstride, get them landing closer under the hips, that in theory would help performance too. We don't have any evidence for that, but anecdotally, I tend to find it's quite helpful, especially for many of my injured runners. They end up running faster down the track. That could be for a range of reasons, one of which could be mechanics. And I'd make sure that they've got good training habits as well, and talking to them about their understanding of how quickly to build up their loads and load management, and I guess use an opportunity for a bigger picture conversation with them.
And where do you start with your return to running? You mentioned you would do kind of 2 by 2 minutes with a minute off and progress that. If you're starting someone from scratch, do you get them on the treadmill running for a period of time, and then if they're safe and they're confident in that, then starting with that with some walk runs and kind of progress that each day or after a couple of sessions? What would it look like, say, for the first couple of weeks?
Yeah, so I think if we take a step back and just ask the person, what have they been doing activity-wise? And so the first thing I want to make sure is they've actually got some capacity to do time on their feet and weight-bearing activities. So if they're really sedentary and they want to start to run, I'd actually give them a walking program, first of all. And I probably want to get them up to walking 20 or 30 minutes. So the first month might be actually getting them walking. As they go back to running, if they've had an injury in the past, it's going to vary a little bit on the injury. Coming back from, say, a stress fracture will be very different to a mild tendinopathy, would be very different to a really severe tendinopathy, would be different depending on patellofemoral symptoms. We already had the conversation, where's the pain come from? But maybe they do have some bone edema, so we're going to be a bit more cautious with that. So I usually start off with a bit of a framework around doing, as part of a 20-minute or 30-minute walk, doing 2 sets of 2 minutes. Now, if I'm worried about irritability, I might back that off and do 2 by 1 minute instead. So think about your stress fracture population. And I would stick to that. I'd do that for 3 sessions for the first week and try not to do consecutive days. And then after that, we would add blocks to it. So we're doing 2 by 2 minutes. Week 2 would be 3 by 2 minutes. Then week 3, we might say, okay, we're getting sick of 2-minute blocks. We'll increase it slightly. And so instead of going to 4 by 2, now we'll do 3 by 3s instead. And then we just gradually build up. And typically most people will build back up to a sort of 25, 30-minute run over a 12-week period pretty safely, regardless of the injury or even a sedentary population. It's often interesting to have a conversation about start to run programs that they might be considering. So something like Couch to 5K is a really good example. And I love talking about this when I teach my course because lots of people do it. And we actually did a feasibility study on it a few years ago, and most people drop out around week 5 to 6. But in week 5, you actually go from a max 5 minutes of running to a max of 20 minutes of running in the space of a couple of runs. So it's just going back to the point, just being really sensible and just gradually building it up.
Yeah, I've definitely found that clinically as well. Anecdotally, when I talk to patients, it's certainly around that sort of time period where it just becomes this unrealistic jump that becomes quite daunting for them. What about hills? Are you ever incorporating like uphill running programs for those really chronic irritable patellofemoral pain or even IT band pain patients to try and reduce that overall load around the knee?
Really, really great question. Hills can be really good and really bad depending on what your injury is. Going up a hill for someone who's got chronic persistent knee pain, essentially it forces you into more knee flexion when you hit the ground. So your quads are in a lot better position to load, and it reduces your actual loads as well. So you actually impact loads. So you can often get people doing, I guess, harder running sessions going up a hill. So I don't tend to go too much to hills if they're not running on the flat, at least slowly. You can arguably, you could do that, but I tend to use it more so as a way to progress people to doing more difficult or I guess more speed type running that they want to do. So they want to perform. So I use this a lot. I use it a lot in elite athletes as an example. We just get them on the treadmill and we just do interval sessions on the treadmill going up a hill while they're maybe still working on their running mechanics on the flat and we're still just trying to slowly build their loads back up. Importantly, though, if you do hills, I think if you want to get the most out of it, you've got to really think carefully about your running form too. There is a little bit of research, and I can't remember the author, so apologies, but there is a study that looks at doing some repeated hill sprints, and I think it was around an 8 to 10% incline. And when they randomized one group to match their step rate and the other group just to run up the hill, and the group who matched their step rate, when they went back to the flat, had a reduced contact time, had an increased flight time. So basically all the things, all the metrics we think would improve performance. So I think if you focus on things like matching your step rate, your pelvic positioning going up the hill, I think you also get more out of it as well.
Match it to the same as what your step rate would be when you're running on flat. Is that
exactly
what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And it makes sense, right? Because when you do that, what you're doing is you're keeping your contact times down. So from a rate of force development and capacity building perspective, that's what you're optimizing by doing that.
Because you typically would increase your step rate when you're running up a hill, right?
Decrease.
And then decrease it down. No.
No, okay. you'll decrease.
Just running slower.
you'll decrease it going up and you'll also decrease it going down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's something I'm going to pay attention to, just selfishly on my own running.
So I think typically, I don't have any great data on this, but probably more anecdotal from the clinic, most people will drop off between 5 and 10% if you put them on a 10% incline.
I find clinically uphill running to be quite difficult. I've tried to incorporate it in the management of knee pain, but most runners don't have a gym membership, I find, so it's hard to get them onto a treadmill. And so if you're getting them to do an uphill running program, then they're also running downhill, which isn't very helpful if they're quite irritable.
Or they have to be disciplined and walk down the hill.
Yeah, but sometimes that's quite sore too.
Yeah,
like
sometimes,
It sounds really good in theory, and when I first learned about it, I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to use this all the time. And then, yeah, I found clinically I probably have, used it less and less because it's actually quite hard to implement, I found.
Yeah, but that's probably why, going back to the population I'm more commonly using, it's often the elite setting because they'll have access to a gym and they can do it. Yeah. And I'd rather them do that than try and get on the Ultra G and run fast, which just does all sorts of wacky things with your mechanics, like just get them loading.
Yeah, cool. I like that idea. That's great.
Do you think that you can just bring someone back to running if they don't have any deficit just by really getting the dosage right of their running? So let's say you've assessed them, they don't have any deficit at any local or non-local level. You can just dose their tissues and their capacity building with just getting the running programming right instead of doing other things, like purely just that on its own?
Yeah, so the population where that's going to be very valuable to is the one who's just had a recent injury, right? So up until a month ago, they've been fine, they've been running along well, no problems. And then they've just had a big spike in their loads, or something else has happened in their life and they're not looking after themselves as well. And so then they've developed this niggle in their knee or Achilles or whatever it might be. And absolutely, the load management part there is going to be enough. But if someone's had a persistent injury, anything longer than a couple of months, they're going to have impairments. Like that's a given. The research is really strong on that too. Like you look at someone with Achilles even, because often we talk about patellofemoral pain and we've got these local and proximal and distal deficits that develop. Someone with Achilles, there's a very good chance they've got hip weakness, and the research consistently shows that when it looks at it. So you're going to need to consider whether that impairment matters to that person. Arguably, I know some people would argue, don't worry about it, just gradually build up their capacity. My bias is let's address the impairment so they've got the greatest capacity possible, so they can get away with doing more. Depends on the person as to whether they want to do that too. Some people will be quite happy just participating, but we see it clinically all the time where people, they don't address their impairments. They do gradually build up their running. At some point, they break down again with the same injury or another injury. And I guess a lot of the people I see clinically have had long-term persistent injuries. So I'm probably seeing a slightly biased population. But I think most of you out there listening to this, a lot of the runners you do see, they've had a persistent injury or they've had multiple injuries. There's going to be impairments there that are probably worth addressing.
And as you said, there's correlation to not just for their running, but their overall ecosystem of health. It's not just, it might make you a better runner or it might help your injury. It's going to help you probably just be able to get through life a bit easier as well.
I mean, just a simple thing, we know that quadriceps weakness is a risk factor for both development and progression of knee osteoarthritis. Now, we don't have any great research that says if you get that population who's weaker, stronger, does that then, and you do an RCT on that, does that then lead to them having less progression of OA? We don't have that, but logically it would make sense that if we get them stronger, their likelihood of progression or the rate of progression is going to be lower. So why not do it? Considering the other side effects of exercise are pretty positive, why not just do it if someone's happy to do it?
What about, is there any data to suggest that persistent patellofemoral pain might lead to patellofemoral joint osteoarthritis or arthritis? I think, like, even just based off what you've said just then, I'd imagine if someone had persistent patellofemoral pain and some quads inhibition, then therefore that could lead to something like osteoarthritis. But is there any data to suggest that?
It's a long-standing hypothesis that's yet to be proven, Kelly. To do these types of studies is really hard, so it takes a really long prospective period of time with a big cohort to understand that. So we have lots of theoretical links, and the characteristics and impairments you see in someone with PFOA and younger person patellofemoral pain are very similar. It looks like it's on a continuum, but there's no real great data out there to confirm that. If I was a betting person, and I'm not a betting person, but if I was, I'd put a fair bit of money on it if you gave me good odds that they were linked.
Kelly's only asking that question because when she gets up in the morning after a hill run the day before, she's like, I've definitely got PFJOA every single time. That's why she wants to know if it's coming in 20 years.
Kelly probably needs to work a bit harder and keep her step rate up going up the hill.
Got to keep an eye on that one for sure. Do you think what has led to the idea that it is like very much involving the cartilage of the patellofemoral joint, or is that just a theory that's been thrown out there?
I think if you've got, when we talk about patellofemoral pain, really we're just using fancy Latin words to say they've got pain somewhere around their kneecap, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
So in some cases it is the cartilage, and I think the clinical presentation where you tend to pick up bone edema, they'll present to you clinically and they'll often start off where the pain kind of builds after a period of time with their run. So it happens a bit later. And often there's a fair bit of a delay in their pain as well. So like the pain will be worse that night and maybe the next day. And I think commonly they're the population when you scan them. This is anecdotal, but when you scan them, you'd probably find some form of bone edema. And in that case, then it is going to be related to the cartilage or just overload or both. So if your cartilage is thinner, then you've got less cushioning, you're more likely to develop bone edema. But the really important message for you to give to your patients about that is that even if you've got thinner cartilage, you still need to load that cartilage to keep it healthy. So you're not going to prevent OA developing or progressing by stopping running. So I'm sure we can dive into that whole topic another time. But then you've also got other structures in the anterior knee that are often symptomatic. And this is where taping and things can be helpful, but it might be the infrapatellar fat pad, which is a massive structure in the anterior knee. And it doesn't take a lot of irritation of that to be quite significantly painful. And that can cause symptoms under the kneecap, below the kneecap. It can almost mimic patellar tendon type symptoms at times. So it could be that. You may have a very sensitized retinaculum, could be that. Like I had a girl last week where that seemed to be the side of the pain. It was just seemed to be not the joint, just really probably where the retinacula was. So it's, and again, we can't be conclusive with that. So I think cartilage can be part of it and bone edema, but there's also a lot of other structures that can be the case. And going back to what you mentioned before, like it's really hard to diagnose a specific spot, but you still know what to do when you manage it, right? Because regardless, you're trying to biomechanically at least reduce load on that joint by doing some resistance training, getting stronger, building capacity both locally, proximally, distally, and shifting some load away or improving how you load through that joint. And if that's helping their symptoms, that's okay. It doesn't matter what the structure was really.
And then everything that we've sort of just spoken about management wise, would that change at all if we are rehabbing an adolescent versus an adult?
So adolescents are less likely to have significant impairments, I think, especially younger. And there's actually research on this. So some of Michael Ratliff's work based in Denmark would show that younger adolescent populations don't have impairments in their quads and hip strength compared to their peers, but older adolescents start to have those impairments like an adult would. So I think it comes back to, again, probably the persistence of the condition. So, and very anecdotally, adolescent comes to you with patellofemoral pain and they've only had the symptoms for a couple of months. They probably don't have many muscle impairments. They've probably just been playing too much sport in most cases. So have a conversation with them, their parents, they're often multiple coaches they've got, sometimes for the same sport. They're playing for football or netball for three different teams and everyone's expecting to train every session and play every game. So have some conversations and manage those loads. But if someone's had pain for a period of time, even if they're adolescent, there's a good chance they're going to have some muscle impairment. So it comes down to your assessment and looking for that and trying to address it. So I think it depends on the individual in front of you rather than blanket saying adolescents are this and adults are this and PFOA is this. You've just got to look at the person in front of you and do a thorough assessment.
So it's almost like the, you know, PFJ kind of sits at the top and there's all these subcategories, but in reality, as long as you can be clear to rule out the nasty sinister stuff, you kind of treat the person and the clinical symptoms.
Yep, absolutely.
How do you find patient, and I'm sure that there's not too much research on this in the running population, but anecdotally, how much are the people you're seeing wanting a specific diagnosis? Are you finding they want to know exactly what's going on, or that they're okay with just knowing, you know, it is load-related knee pain or patellofemoral joint syndrome?
I don't think so. People often say the patient comes to you and they want a diagnosis. I think it's partially true, but actually, I think what they want to do is they want to understand why they've got pain. I think that's what they're after. And having a diagnosis and a label can sometimes help with that, but sometimes it doesn't either. So I think the better approach is rather than trying to focus on a specific diagnosis, which you can sometimes give, but focusing more so on getting their story, talking through that story, and then talking to them about possible reasons from their story of why they've developed their pain in the first place and then why they have their persistent pain. And I think that's more important than the specific diagnosis. Like, you're not going to tell them they've got FAI when they've got knee pain, right? But you can tell them what that might be the structures, but then understanding all the different sources and what might be driving their symptoms ongoing is probably really important. And then going back to what I mentioned before, that they then want solutions, right? They want to know, they've come to you for help, so they want to know what the solutions are. And so I think focusing on possible drivers of why they have ongoing persistent symptoms, and you can get them to really understand that, then hopefully your interventions are going to address those things, and then your interventions make a lot more sense too, rather than saying, hey, you've got patellofemoral pain, we know from the evidence that hip and knee exercises help that, so that's what we're going to do. You've got some anterior knee pain, and it's probably to do with your kneecap joint, and it might be the fat pad that's being irritated. And when I've assessed you, you've got some hip muscle weakness. If we compare your right to your left, and if we compare you to your peers, and we know that if you've got hip muscle weakness, then you're not going to be able to load as much through there, which means more load on your knee. I've checked your quads and they're actually really strong. That's probably because you're using them all the time. So therefore, what we're going to try and do is we're going to work on building up your hip strength. And alongside that, we're going to get you playing less of your sports, because part of the reason you develop this is you're doing too much. And this is a very specific example, but that's kind of the process to go through, I think.
And assessing that proximal weakness, I mean, for the podiatrist listening, that imagine the foot and the ankle, and Achilles tendinopathy is quite a common presentation in the clinic. They should be assessing knee, quad, hamstring, hip, core stability, all in that session, as well as their calf and Achilles capacity.
Yeah, exactly. And I did my running course on the weekend in Melbourne, and we had podiatry, osteo, chiro, physio, NEP all on the same course. And awesome. I love doing that. And it's great with the podiatrist, because it does take you guys out of your comfort zone when you're like, hey, we're going to assess our gluteal and hip muscle function and some core strength stuff, and then we're going to go through some simple exercises for it. But what I always say to them is, hey, if you can assess some of these things, then you can have a really good understanding about whether the physio they've been seeing is doing a good job or not. And if they're not, you might kindly steer them somewhere else if you need to. Or if they haven't seen anyone else, you can assess it and maybe start them on a few things. You don't have to rehab their hip, but at least if you know it's a potential big problem that's contributing to their condition, you can then make that appropriate referral. Or you can go and reassure them, go, actually, all this stuff is related to what's going on around your foot and ankle, and I've got that, so we're good. So it is important to have those skills, I think.
I don't know if you remember from Richard's course, but I impromptu asked you for a couple of minutes, and I'm having a bit of knee pain, and you actually gave me a couple of cues to it was basically tuck my butt under and get out of it more of an anterior pelvic position. And I went for a long run the next day, and it did feel better with my knee. I had a little bit of soreness at the time, and I can thankfully say Kelly's written me a good hip and knee strengthening program, because my calf and Achilles, I'm bouncy strong, but I've definitely got some proximal weakness, so it definitely can there. I didn't even think of it as well. Like, I felt strong there, but assessing it isolated, it definitely wasn't. So glad to have worked on that. But the cues definitely help, but now I don't have the cue because it's stronger.
You jogged my memory on that now. Yeah, I forgot we did that. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it helped. So there's an N of one to prove what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, it was like a classic family gathering. I was like, hey, I've got knee pain, help me. Give me 20 seconds, no context at all, but it did help, which was good.
I have one final question for you, Christian, and I've just been enjoying asking a lot of our guests this question, because I feel like you really understand, you know, research and the problems that sometimes pop up with trying to disseminate research and actually carry out research. But if you could conduct one piece of research right now, or ask one research question that there was no barriers and your funds were unlimited and ethics were irrelevant, what would it be?
One research question. How do we change politicians' behaviours to get them to better fund exercise and physical activity instead of so much medicine and drugs and surgery?
I like it. Right on the spot too. There was no prompting for that prior, so I like it.
Yeah, health policy matters a lot more than probably what we understand as clinicians, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating. Yeah, having spent the last 6 or 7 years really trying to push some agendas around physical activity and exercise, so not just talking about the geeky stuff we've been talking about, just actually how do we get policy to focus on physical activity participation in community, it's a big challenge.
Yeah, because all the research that I have read, any type of PA seems to have this bucket load of good benefit, but it's the barrier to people doing it. It's like that's just the middle part that we can't seem to bridge. Like, we know it helped. That is so clear now. You can't dispute that anymore, but it's getting to people engaged with that consistently seems to be the biggest trouble, right? And obviously, as clinicians, people are coming to see us for pain, but there's no reason, which Kelly and I both do, and I'm sure you do as well, talking to people. Like, had someone this morning with some midfoot osteoarthritis, just talking to them about, yes, their foot and the ankle, but can we get you engaging with some more physical activity during the week just to help your overall systemic health, which is going to help your foot as well anyway, indirectly.
And that's right. So the clinicians listening in, we often think, oh, we need better funding for what we do, which we do. So we need better funding to support people to be more physically active. But we need to sort of, I guess, reinforce that with better bike paths and better exercise facilities and exercise services for the community that are freely available or inexpensive. We need simple things like streetlights on footpaths and through parks and things, so people can go out and exercise and feel safe. We need some places don't even have anywhere to exercise. Like, they're just building massive amounts of houses in housing estates with very little infrastructure for exercise. So, anyway, it's a big complex problem that government doesn't seem to focus on.
Yeah. Now, the last question, and we, to give you some context, our last podcast guest actually said the Dalai Lama as their answer. So if you could interview anyone today, alive or not, who would it be and what would you talk about? And you happy if you want to say a podiatrist, you can talk about foot orthoses, that answer's okay as well if you want to.
I forgot you were asking this question. Who would I interview?
And what would you talk about? Topic, I guess, one or two topic.
I'd probably like to interview Elon Musk, and I'd like to understand how he's managed to both be innovative and creative what he does and how to develop the influence he has managed to have on the world. I think he mostly does good things. How's he managed to do that, and how's he effective in doing it? And yeah, any advice you could give us as health professionals to go back to answer some of the things that we were just talking about before.
Yes, his memoir is going to be quite a good read in 10, 15 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, if people want to find you, whether it be courses or socials and emails and things, where is the best way to make that connection? And do you have anything upcoming in this year? I know you just had your running injury-related course down in Melbourne, but is there anything on the horizon this year or next year?
Yeah, so I've got a few different courses. So patellofemoral course that I do as well. There's an APA one coming up very soon in a few weeks. We're doing it at the clinic later in the year. The best place to keep a tab of courses and events and things we're doing is the clinic website. So it's complete.clinic. That's it. There's no .com, no .au, etc. Just complete.clinic. And that's probably the easiest way to reach out. You could just contact the reception team there and get in touch. Otherwise, on Twitter, I'm, or X, should we call it these days, thanks to Elon, I'm at Dr. Chris Barton. For various reasons, I haven't done a lot of social media lately. I have the same handle on Instagram, but I'm actually made a commitment at some point soon. I'm going to start embracing Instagram a little bit more, so you might start to find me on there. But for various COVID and then subsequent family reasons, I haven't done a lot on social media for the last couple of years, but that will hopefully change soon.
Yep, that'll be it. It'd be nice to see your face on Instagram talking about some running related stuff rather than a couple of influencers having a 10-second video saying, hey, you need to change this and this will solve all your injuries and you'll never get injured again, and buy my course if possible. I've got the answers.
Okay, I'll look forward to exploring it and maybe asking them some questions.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks, Blake.